Oscar-winning filmmaker Alex Gibney has been on the show many times over the years. He's tackled a wide range of topics in his documentaries, including Enron, torture at Abu Ghraib, and Elliot Spitzer. His latest, Mea Maxima Culpa, begins with the story of abuse of students at a school for the deaf outside of Wisconsin, outside of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and what makes matters even worse is where the trail goes from there. Mea Maxima Culpa will be shown on HBO this coming Monday at 9 o'clock, and then it opens at the Film Forum on February 20th. I'm always pleased to welcome Alex Gibney to our show. Hello.
Delighted to be here.
You certainly can't be accused of having just one kind of beat, can you? So what is it about a story that will grab you?
It's hard to know. I mean, I guess, and I get this from other people because I just sort of go after stories where and when they seem to take me. But I think, you know, abuse of power is probably something that turns my crank.
Have you started looking into a story and then have stopped because things just didn't work out?
That rarely happens. Usually a story either comes to me or I decide to embark on a story. And if there's enough there, if there's smoke, there's usually fire.
Well, there have been other movies about the topic of abuse in the Catholic Church. What was it about the one that begins your film that caught your attention?
There were two things. I first read about it in a piece in the New York Times by Laurie Goodstein. And one thing was that this story about a priest in Milwaukee, Wisconsin named Lawrence Murphy, who abused over 200 deaf children. As horrible as that was, the intriguing thing to me was the fact that documents revealed in the course of that case took the story right on up to the top of the Vatican. And when I say the top, I mean the tippy top, Cardinal Ratzinger, now Pope Benedict. And so a lot of stories had been done about isolated cases of abuse. Nobody had kind of put the dots together to reveal the larger pattern involved. And the other thing that I think intrigued me about it was the deaf men at the heart of the story, who are not just victims. I mean, they were heroes in the sense that they worked very hard to expose this.
So you didn't have to work all that hard to track down the abuse survivors who you feature in the film, Terry Kohut, Gary Smith, Pat Kuhn, and Arthur Budzinski?
Some had been public before, some had not been public. One was known as John Doe. John Doe, now known as Terry Kohut, sued the Pope. But he hadn't really been public before, so we persuaded him to come on camera, which was difficult, but I think also liberating for him.
Well, difficult because these people are deaf and they communicate through American Sign Language. And you decided not to use subtitles?
On purpose. I wanted people to be looking at them. There's something magnificently expressive about American Sign Language. And I didn't want people to be reading subtitles. I wanted them to be looking at the faces and looking at the hands.
You start off with archival footage of the boys. They seem so innocent and vulnerable, which makes seeing what happened all the more horrific. How did you obtain that footage?
Some of that footage, Super 8 footage, was shot by Terry Kohut. Terry Kohut, it turns out, was quite a good camera person and shot a lot of footage of St. John's. Other students had also shot footage of St. John's. Even St. John's had shot footage of St. John's. When you go looking for stuff, it's amazing what you find.
We've heard of a lot about cases of abuse in other cities, but not Milwaukee. What do you think that is?
Hard to know. I mean, in a way, the abuse in Milwaukee may have been covered up in part because it was such a Catholic city. It's a very Catholic city, Milwaukee. And one of the trends in this story was that law enforcement did not do nearly enough as it should have to uncover these crimes.
Well, how did the fact that these kids were deaf complicate the whole story?
I mean, in the most fundamental way, it was very difficult for them to communicate with the outside world. In one way, it's understandable that they were victims because the predator, Lawrence Murphy, was actually a very good signer and raised a lot of money for the deaf school. But he used the confessional, which was very abhorrent. It was terrible. But he used the confessional to find out information about these kids. And one of the things he used to find out was whether or not their parents could sign. And he would go after kids in particular if their parents couldn't sign so that they couldn't really communicate with them.
Did any of the kids wind up being able to tell their parents what was happening?
Yes, they did. And a number of parents then tried to engage in some kind of legal action against the church, often foiled, but there started to be anger. And indeed, by 1974, after, 15 years of abuse at the school, Lawrence Murphy was drummed out of his position at St. John's.
You mentioned the Pope when he was Cardinal Ratzinger. What about New York's own Cardinal, Timothy Dolan? What role does he play in the story?
Well, an interesting role. He was also Archbishop of Milwaukee. And there are a number of people who feel very strongly that one of the things that Timothy Dolan did was to try to denude the archdiocese of financial resources so that it wouldn't be available to survivors seeking some kind of restitution. In particular, he put $55 million into a cemetery trust, a rather handsome amount for a cemetery.
Because he knew that somewhere down the line there were going to be court cases.
Yeah, you know, there were court cases already proceeding, and indeed Milwaukee was in great jeopardy of having to denude itself. The archdiocese of Milwaukee was in great danger of having denuded itself of a lot of cash. The archdiocese has since gone bankrupt, and in part they've gone bankrupt because of all the money that was moved off their books, and now they're in bankruptcy.
Cases of abuse keep on cropping up. There's the cover-up of the predator priests by Cardinal Roger Mahoney of Los Angeles, a much-loved cleric. Church leaders are, he said, not mandatory reporters of alleged sexual abuse, I guess, in California. In New York State, is that? Or in
Mahoney,
California?
Mahoney is in California.
Yeah. But do they – would he have had to have revealed what he knew by law?
By law, he should have done. But I think one of the really interesting things that's being uncovered, and it was uncovered in the Mahoney case, was that through documents obtained through civil suits, we're beginning to see – the systemic nature of the cover-up inside the Catholic Church. It was these documents that revealed Mahoney's role and his willingness to move priests around instead of to identify them.
You requested interviews at the Vatican. What response did you get?
I would say our requests were met with utter silence. You know, they all refused to speak to us. We were particularly interested in speaking to people at this office called the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which is the office that Cardinal Ratzinger ran for many years.
Were you surprised that the Reverend Rembert Wicklund did agree to get involved?
I was pleasantly surprised.
Did you try to reach him for a while?
I did. I tried to reach him for a number of months, and he finally agreed to speak. He was a very interesting figure and was a very high-ranking figure and also knew Ratzinger rather well. So it was a very important thing that he came on board to talk to this case.
What do you think finally led Terry Kohut to decide to sue not only the Vatican but Pope Benedict as well?
I think because he felt at the end of the day that this was not an isolated incident. Father Murphy was not a bad apple in the sense that the cover-up of his crime was more problematic than the crime itself in a way, and that cover-up led right on up to the top. Because one of the things we know about the Milwaukee case was that priests were reporting Father Murphy to representatives of the Vatican going back to the 1960s.
The sense you get is that the church, despite its numbers and its power, felt that it was under attack, and that was a reason to do all this covering up.
It's interesting the way that works. You know, the church is an institution of enormous wealth and power. But we also see it on Wall Street. You know, I've seen very powerful investment bankers on Wall Street react like helpless victims when they receive the slightest bit of criticism. I don't know what it is about people who have enormous power. When they're criticized at all, they seem to react as if they're somehow victims themselves.
My guest is Alex Gibney, whose latest film, which he directed and produced, is called Maxima Culpa, which means
through my most grievous fault. In the Mass, you would say mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa.
It airs on HBO this coming Monday, the 4th at 9 p.m. It'll also open at the Film Forum on February 20th. Did you grow up a Catholic?
I did. I was raised Catholic.
So did some of your attitudes change while you were working on this film?
I don't know that my attitudes changed. I think it was, you know, I'm not a practicing Catholic now. I think, though, the important thing about my Catholicism in making this film is that I tried terribly hard to make a very big distinction between faith and the faithful and the actions of the hierarchy. I see this not a film about religion as much as a film about crime. This is a crime film.
But I wonder why the crime occurred all over the place. Just yesterday, Reverend Charles Engelhardt was convicted of child sexual abuse in Philadelphia. And we've been hearing stories about similar things happening all over the world. Do you have any sense why this particular offense was so ubiquitous?
I think it was ubiquitous, but also the fact that we're hearing about it now also testifies to a greater willingness to expose the offense. I think it was always there, hiding due to the cultural secrecy of the institution. And now that civil institutions are becoming more willing to go after the church, we're seeing more and more and more of it.
Has anyone from the church responded to your film?
We've gotten some predictable responses from the Catholic League, and those are...
Bill Donahue.
Yes. He referred to me as a fraud, I believe was the word he used. But I don't take those too seriously. The Catholics I know who've seen the film are very moved by it because they also draw... They realize that I'm drawing that distinction between the faithful and the hierarchy.
You mentioned Wall Street as a response to criticism. Can you find similar stories in other structures and institutions?
Well, let's look at Penn State. I mean, you know, look at the defensiveness with which Penn State reacted to this, or the way in which Penn State tried to cover up pedophilia inside of its own institution. Also, the Boy Scouts. I mean, we talk about something in the film. We call it noble cause corruption, which is a phrase that police departments often use for cops who like plant marijuana on suspects who committed much bigger crimes and they can't get them any other way. And the idea is that when you feel you're so inherently good, you can't accept the idea that you could do anything bad.
Has Reverend Wicklund suffered at all as a result of his participation?
I don't think so. I mean, frankly, Reverend Wicklund, you know, had already had a kind of checkered career. He had there was a scandal in which he was involved with a consenting male adult in which she tried to prevent blackmail by giving him a payoff of $450,000 of church funds. So, you know, he had his own scandal to contend with. But I don't think he's I have gotten some response back from him since I saw the film, but I haven't heard from him recently. I think when the film airs on HBO, there'll probably be a lot more public response.
Mm-hmm. I wonder about how many projects you have in the works at any given time.
There's usually two or three boiling, you know, at any particular time, and in part because, you know, these investigative projects sometimes don't move according to a time frame. And, you know, the case of Reverend Wicklund is a case in point. I mean, it would have been a shame if we hadn't gotten somebody of his rank in the hierarchy to have come forward. And so sometimes it pays to delay films in order to get people to talk.
Well, this film is just being released, but you already had another film at Sundance, didn't you?
Yes, We Steal Secrets, the story of WikiLeaks.
Again, well, you depend on leaks, don't you?
I do.
For all of your films?
I do. Now, We Steal Secrets, I should say, just as an aside, is actually a quote from Michael Hayden, former director of the CIA. He looks into the camera and very boldly says, "Alex, you must understand, we steal secrets. That's what we do."
Did your take on Julian Assange change over the course of the filming?
I think it did. I mean, the fact is I have a great deal of admiration for him in many ways. But I think also I recognize that things that I thought were true about him were not true.
Well, when you make films about flawed characters, you're going to discover all sorts of interesting things. Didn't you have a project involving Lance Armstrong?
I still do. I'm still working on it.
Were you surprised of what he said to Oprah?
I can't say. I was surprised that he said it, in the sense that to see Lance Armstrong in a position where he was actually coming forward and admitting to that wrongdoing was a surprise. And I think, you know, having known him a bit, I think what was interesting to me, a lot of people weren't at all pleased by his confession and were angry because he seemed to be imperious. What I actually saw that was interesting was that he found himself in a very uncomfortable position, and that position of having to apologize.
Although the 60 Minutes went after him and said that much of what he said wasn't true. he was protecting himself, and also protecting himself with the statute of limitations, which is something that has also happened with the church. They've tried to prevent new legislation that would drop the statute of limitations in the case of child sex abuse. Where does the Milwaukee court case stand now?
There is still an ongoing bankruptcy case, and it is the hope of the survivors that as part of that case, many, many, many more documents will ultimately be released. And I'm told that those documents haven't been released, there's a lot more in those documents that reveal connections with the Vatican.
And for many of the people involved, it seems to be more important to them to have the story told than to get the money.
Yes, I think if you were to really push the survivors on this, their big issue is give us the documents.
There you have a scene in your film where a woman yells at one of the survivors, "Are you really a good Catholic?" She is less concerned about what's happened to this guy and more about what the revelations will do to the Catholic Church.
It's about the institution. She's saying, take one for the team.
Alex Gibney's new film, Mea Maxima Culpa, airs on HBO this coming Monday, and then it'll open on the Film Forum on February 20th. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you, Len. Always a pleasure.